This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Thursday, April 11th. Alberta says Ottawa can't cut any deals with Alberta municipalities without provincial approval. Just ahead, the mayor of Calgary is here to react. And Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland is ruling out new taxes on the middle class in next week's budget. The Power Panel is here to discuss what Canadians can expect. Plus, an exclusive interview with French Prime Minister Gabriel Attal, what he says about European security and the possibility of a second Trump presidency. We begin with Alberta and the firewall it's building against the federal government. Daniel Smith's government has tabled a bill that would allow it to block funding deals between Ottawa and Alberta municipalities.
We are taking back more of our jurisdictional control and telling Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his cabinet that they cannot make deals without our express approval. Through this legislation, which signals that Alberta will act to ensure the Constitution's integrity and that we won't put up with any further manipulation or political interference from Ottawa.
The only federal cabinet minister from Alberta says this kind of legislation will slow down agreements and keep money out of communities.
Roadblocks and obstacles in that way, in getting in the way of that funding is only going to hurt Albertans. I think we respect those jurisdictions, but we're not going to sit at the sidelines and wait for provinces to act when Canadians want us to do new programs.
For the municipality's perspective on this, we've reached Jyoti Gondek, the mayor of Calgary, and she joins me now. Mayor Gondek, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What effect do you think this new legislation will have on Calgary getting funding from the federal government?
I think it stands to create more red tape, create slowdowns in approvals, and honestly cost more money for all Albertans as we have another order of government sifting through agreements. So I think it's going to slow things down at a time when our city is seeing growth in the neighborhood of 60 people a day moving here. We need to get housing built. We need to improve infrastructure, and we are relying on federal funding for that. And we need to expedite processes, not put up barriers to them.
Okay, so this doesn't just apply, though, to new agreements going forward. It's also looking a bit backwards. I mean, what's your reaction to the fact that the provincial government has flagged hundreds of existing agreements and described them as problematic?
I would love to have some sort of reaction to that, but my only reaction is I have no idea what they flagged as problematic. I don't know what their criteria for problematic is. I don't know if Calgary is one of the 800. I don't actually know anything. There's not enough information for me to be able to weigh in.
Okay, so if any of your existing federal-provincial agreements are a problem here, nobody has told you anything, and I guess uncertainty like that is not helpful when you're trying to plan.
Yeah, uncertainty and unpredictability are the last thing we need right now. We are a city that has recovered from an incredible downturn. We went through the pandemic, and we are slowly coming back to our full potential. We are the economic driver. We're the economic engine, not only for our province, but also for our country. And so in order to be able to generate economic benefit for the nation and our province, we need to be able to strike deals and have grants and funding coming from the federal government so that we can keep our city strong and make sure that the hard-earned tax dollars that are leaving our city are actually returning here for investment into our communities.
So your city has a deal with the federal government, as I understand, if I'm remembering correctly, under the Housing Accelerator Fund. Do you have any idea what this legislation could mean for that agreement?
I don't know what it could mean for that agreement. I don't know what it could mean for any agreements for any of our municipalities or our school boards or our post-secondary institutions. There's frankly very little information for us to weigh in on, and that's why many of us are raising the flag that this is problematic to table legislation and then say you're going to do a consultation. Should have probably been the other way around. So I'm as curious as you are about what's been flagged and what's deemed problematic, and frankly, what are the priorities of the province?
Well, you know, I'm trying to figure out how this might intersect with what we're seeing from the federal government, because they've been rolling out programs in advance of the budget. As you know, one of their big pre-budget announcements includes a municipal infrastructure fund, essentially, with strings attached for the provinces to get that funding if they meet certain conditions. And if they don't, it flows around them and it goes to municipalities. If Daniel Smith's government is going to put conditions like this in the way, and there's an inability for the Alberta government and the federal government to work together, but then they can't go to municipalities and cut deals with mayors like you because of this legislation. That means potentially Calgary, Edmonton, where the UCP has no representation, could get cut out of these billions of dollars.
I mean, I think it's important to remember that the billions of dollars that are being being put forward by the federal government are accessible to any municipality. And so, you know, when we hear a statement like Calgary is receiving money, but we need to make sure that everybody else is getting their fair share, I will tell you that mayors like me from across this country fought hard for 2.5 years with the federal government, telling them that they weren't investing enough in municipalities. And we finally got to a point where they've announced $6 billion just last week. That's because we put up such a fuss in the name of every municipality who now has access to this money. So we've been doing exactly what the province is saying they're doing. We're fighting for our fair share. And in fact, we've advocated for all municipalities, not just ours.
So how do you think this could play out, though? I mean, as you say, there is a lot of things we don't know about this particular piece of legislation. But Premier Smith it seems pretty intent on pushing back against what she considers to be federal intrusion into her jurisdiction. She likes to cite examples of comparable legislation that we've seen in Quebec. But it seems as though with the parameters laid out in this budget announcement by the federal government, if she does this and if Daniel Smith won't agree to making fourplexes as of right everywhere, for example, in Alberta, and then blocks you from signing an agreement with the federal government, you're just not going to get the cash. Calgary becomes completely at the mercy of the provincial government here.
Well, yes. And I mean, I think there's something important to consider in all of this. We as municipalities, and my city in particular, has been put squarely in the middle of a debate that is between the provincial and federal governments. They are at ideological war with each other, and they are identifying things that they don't like about each other's philosophies. And for them to enter into this kind of a battle and put cities at the mercy of, you know, their whims is absolutely unacceptable. I mean, we were elected to represent our constituents, and Calgarians expect me to be fighting for the dollars that they put out in income tax to be coming back to us. And that's exactly what I've done together with other mayors. And to now hear that our province wants to block the ability to get much needed funding makes no sense to me. You use the Quebec example. In the Quebec example, Quebec has agreed to match the funding.
Right.
So if that's something that our province wants to do, I'd be happy to hear about it.
Well, no, this is the thing. A lot of the premiers say they want the Quebec agreement, but Quebec brings its own money to the table when in a lot of cases the provincial governments have not outside of Quebec on things such as housing. So you have your frustration here with what the provincial government is doing. Given this pushback, does the federal government need to change its approach, or does your frustration rest entirely with Premier Smith here?
My frustration rests with two orders of government who should know better. They know they need to work together, and they are letting ideologies get in the way. I mean, the federal government is going across the country making announcements, coming to Alberta, making announcements without telling me, without telling the premier. And so in some ways, they are also guilty of poking the bear. So I would love for these two orders of government to actually understand how critical it is at this point in time in our country and in my city for them to get along and make sure that we are delivering the services and the infrastructure that the people are desperately reliant on those two orders of government for.
I'm not sure these two governments will find a way to necessarily get along on some things. I mean, how do you view this? It's not a relationship. Occasionally, things go well, you know, when they're investing in net zero, industry in rural Alberta and northern Alberta. But like on sort of baseline fed, provincial, municipal programs, there is a persistent tension here. I mean, do you think this can be resolved in time for you to take advantage of some of this cash? Or does this all have to wait for a federal election to sort of clear the air here?
I really hope they can understand that the public has spoken. The public has told us that they are incredibly concerned about housing. They are incredibly concerned about public safety. And they are incredibly concerned about the economy. And as a local government, there's only so much we can do. We have made $80 million worth of investments into those things in last year's budget alone. And so I would say maybe they can take a tip from us. We're willing to do the right thing and stand up for the things that our constituents need. They need to get a handle around doing the same, and they need to put their ideologies aside.
So what happens to Calgary if they don't get this resolved? And this looks to be some sort of a standoff where federal money stops at the Alberta border on some of these programs.
If the federal money does not flow to not only my city, but to all municipalities, then we become dependent on the provincial government for funding. Because the one thing about municipalities in our province, we cannot carry a deficit. So the only way that we could even begin to deliver the amount of infrastructure and services that we need their funding for is to increase property taxes. And we don't want to do that. We shouldn't have to do that. So I would implore both orders of government to understand that the money that they are playing with right now is desperately needed in municipalities, and they need to set aside their differences and do the right thing. If they want the economic engine of the province and the country to stay alive and do well, they better come up with a way to get along.
Jody Gondek, Mayor of Calgary, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland is making changes to mortgage rules to help young Canadians get a foot in the door in the housing market. Freeland also confirmed that recent spending won't mean a deeper deficit and laid out her approach to the middle class in next week's budget.
Our belief is we need to invest in middle-class Canadians, support middle-class Canadians, and we will not be raising taxes on the middle class.
All right, we're going to bring in the power panel now. Cameron Ahmad is former head of communications to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. James Moore is a former Conservative cabinet minister. Andrew Thompson is a former Saskatchewan NDP cabinet minister. And Shachi Curl is the president of the Angus Reid Institute. Okay, so James, I want to start with you. Freeland says she's going to continue what she calls the government's fiscally responsible approach in next week's budget. We've seen a lot of money rolled out. A lot of it is loans, so it will be tied to assets and not necessarily booked as a deficit. But if they're not going to go over the $40 billion deficit target, what do you make of their ruling out of tax increases on the middle class, but not ruling out of tax increases of any kind in this budget?
Well, I mean, we'll have to obviously wait and see the details on that. But you notice the goalposts keep moving, right, on what constitutes fiscal accountability, fiscal responsibility. I mean, there was, you know, the fiscal guardrails were blown apart a long time ago. Then there weren't any at all because we needed to be there and be on the side of those who are struggling to stay in the middle class and those hoping to join them. And so what constitutes fiscal responsibility is not any measurable standard of consistency that any of us have ever known in the past. If there's no big, large spending, new spending program, then that means that the assumptions or expectations of New Democrats for farmer care, for child care, for an expansion of the dental program, those things I imagine will be shelved because those things have enormous price tags in the out years as those programs grow in size and scope and expectation. So, look, we'll see what the details are on the taxation side. I mean, I assume she's saying that net taxation will not be going up or that income taxes won't be going up or the GST won't be going up. But some taxes are going to be going up, as we know. Consumption taxes of consuming energy, those are going to be going up. So what is going to be offset in order to absorb that cost for everyday Canadians as they drive their kids to and from school and indulge in things like heating their homes? So we'll see what will have to be offsets. So there's no net tax increase, but I'm not, you know, seeing any details on that or frankly holding my breath for anything particularly exceptional.
Cameron, we don't yet know what's going to happen with the tax component of the budget because it's the one thing they haven't announced largely in advance leading into this. We saw the move today, though, on mortgage changes to help first-time buyers get into the market. What do you make of this move? Because I know the Home Builders Association, who we just had on, said this is vital to unlocking supply and demand in the housing market, and it's something that people like Mike Moffitt, Lisa Raitt, and Don Iveson have talked about as helping with housing affordability and supply.
Well, I love it. Another string of practical, real measures that are actually going to help people get into the housing market and building on the other concrete measures that they've been announcing over the past few weeks that are going to make a real difference in people's lives, building more homes, helping vulnerable kids get a healthy meal to eat. And like I said a few weeks ago, I think this is a great approach, and I wish I did it when I was there. It's a great way to try and dominate the conversation, get more focus on big pieces of your budget or smaller ones that may get drowned out on budget day itself and in all the ensuing days when the criticism sort of takes over. But I think it's a smart move. And, you know, it's going to be hard for there for the opposition, if they manage to speak specifically about this issue, which they almost never do, to actually oppose it. Because these are things that, as you pointed out, experts, people who study the issue are going to support and welcome and say this is actually going to practically help people. Anecdotally, we all know someone who's benefited from the savings account. So I think we're tackling housing, which is one of the biggest issues on Canadians' minds right now. We're providing specific concrete proposals that are going to make a real difference in people's lives. What I wanted to hear a little bit more of, and I hope they start to do more in the lead up to the budget and certainly in the budget rollout, is draw that contrast with the alternative, which is, despite Pierre Poilievre not having really articulated any real real alternative or proposal himself, we know that he doesn't believe in a government that invests in people, as Chrystia Freeland was talking about. So I want to hear them talk more about what the alternative is. And if these are measures that you think you, a regular working class family or a young person looking to get into the market, think are going to help you, if you want to see more investments in increasing housing supply, what is the alternative going to look like if you have a government that doesn't believe in doing anything on housing and just has, you know, its usual insults and empty slogans?
Well, but Andrew, on this, despite the promise from Chrystia Freeland that the deficit won't increase beyond the fall economic statement, I still think we're talking about a $40 billion deficit, right? Something that's around 1% of GDP, which, you know, not that long ago would have been considered unacceptable. And it comes after British Columbia gets a credit rating downgrade from a big deficit. Quebec has a big deficit. Ontario has a big deficit. There is a potential saturation point in the government credit in Canada at all levels when you stack it together. I mean, what do you think of where this is going?
Yeah, I think that it was a very realistic and practical announcement that the minister made today. I don't think she has a lot of room to do more borrowing.
Yeah.
That said, there's a lot of demands and there's been a lot of spending announced over the last several weeks. Now, a lot of that is back-ended. The NATO commitments don't come for years. This housing piece, whatever the implications of that are still going to take some time to roll out. So she's bought herself a bit of time in terms of being able to, you know, forenounce the proposals without having to actually pay for them at this point. How long that stays in place, I don't know. And I think that's one of the questions people will be looking at is whether this is, in fact, now a, you know, a hard cap, a floor of how far the deficit can go. Or is there, in fact, they're going to stick to this ratio that they had campaigned on way back in 2015 that I think everyone's kind of looked askance at. So there's a lot of questions still that are going to get answered in the budget. One of the things I would say is about their strategy, having pushed all of the positive stuff out front, does run the risk now on budget day of people putting a lot more attention on what the actual numbers are. Mm-hmm. What does the actual cost of this look like? That's always the upside and the downside of this type of a communication strategy.
Yeah, and Shachi, we certainly saw some of that with the fall economic statement where the measures were very small and fine-tuning. The narrative of that day really became about the economic forecast, the bumpy road ahead of them, you know, the difficult economic time they were facing and the time they had left as a government before they have to have an election. And now they're going to roll out some sort of spending that we've seen at a time when maybe people might not welcome that or might be worried more about the size of the deficit. What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, and I don't have an earache, David. A little bit of audio problems on this side, so that just explains why I'm doing this. Look, back in 2015, Justin Trudeau broke political orthodoxy by saying he was going to run a $10 billion deficit. But the difference is that 8 years ago, the vast majority of Canadians, I believe it was 75% at the time we polled them, said, we're ready for some deficit spending. If it increases social programs, if it betters the lives of Canadians. 8-plus years later, most voters are in a very different place. Data that we put out today from the Angus Reid Institute showing 60% believe government is spending too much. But if you go below the surface on who comprises that 60%, it's quite a story to be told. I mean, not surprising, near unanimous numbers of conservative voters, 87% think that. But notably, 3/4 of Bloc voters, nearly 40% of NDP voters, and even 1 in 3 Liberal voters. And this is that core Liberal vote that in many cases, when it comes to policy or actions or behavior, believes that the Trudeau government continues to be able to do no wrong. Even 1 in 3 of these voters are going, maybe the spending is too much. And if there is going to be more spending, there's a lot of conflicting directional arrows coming from Canadians around how that money should be spent and where it should be prioritized. They actually want to see more health spending, but there's a lot of things, a lot of other areas that they'd like to see dialed back, including spending on climate action. Believe it or not, spending on reconciliation. There's a lot of spending on foreign aid. They'd like to, across the political spectrum, you see pluralities that would like to see that shut down. And then there's also a significant amount of contrast around how you get there on things like dental care and pharmacare and the school food program and some of those other things. Whereas should these programs be brought in by affecting cuts in other places? A significant number say so. Or should they be brought in through new taxes? So again, there may be broad support for some of these spending initiatives, but overall, Canadians, I think, are starting to express that they're getting a bit of the heebie-jeebies around just the amount of spending and what that's going to mean for them long-term, and also the short-term reality that for many of these programs, it's not going to make an immediate impact on their daily lives, although that may come in time.
So, James, how does a government navigate that kind of a dynamic with the balance sheet that they have and the list of demands for help on key issues like housing in a political moment that we're in the runway that got left?
Well, I mean, I guess we'll see next week, but that's what the budget is about. That's what our political dialogue is about. And the answer is it's a question of priorities and emphasis. One of the challenges I think that this Trudeau government has is that when times are good and interest rates are down and the job numbers are good, it's time to invest. When we hit a pandemic, it's time to invest. When times are going tough and we have a inflation crisis and we have cost of living crisis, well, it's time to invest. It's never not time to invest, according to this government, no matter what the circumstances are. And I think the public knows that that's untenable and that it's not credible to have that posture and to have the same position and no matter what the circumstances are around you in the same environment that's happening around you, it erodes your credibility to talk about budgeting fiscal issues and to take care of the Commonwealth interest of the economy. So I think that's the wall that they're up against. So I think Minister Freeland trying to send some messages today to counterbalance that reality is an effort, but it's an effort against the facts. I mean, the public knows that at the end of the day, they're going to have to pay for all of this, and that, you know, endless spending in good times and bad times and average times and pandemic times, that endless spending is not sustainable, and there has to be a path back towards some kind of measure of fiscal balance.
So, Cameron, how do you deal with that? As somebody used to do communications for this government, you know, when there is a fatigue over deficit out there and maybe a greater appetite for a return to a more balanced sort of balance sheet. But, you know, you have the housing challenges, the infrastructure needs, and the political demands of the moment.
Well, it's one thing to talk about spending and deficits in the abstract. It's another to talk about the impacts of cuts on very specific programs and investments that Canadians rely on and what the consequences of doing that would be for middle-class families and working families. I mean, a lot of the investments that we're talking about that the government has made, putting aside the COVID investments, which were hugely important in making sure our economy and our society essentially didn't completely tank during the pandemic. But putting that aside, a lot of the investments have done a huge deal, have had a huge impact in reducing poverty in this country and lifting literally hundreds of thousands of people and kids out of poverty. There are benefits and programs and investments that this government has made that millions of Canadians rely on that didn't exist before or weren't as generous before and certainly weren't as targeted to lower income people. Now, if you talk about removing those investments and the impacts that would have on Canadian families, like the Canada Child Benefit, which is, as you all know, helps the lowest income families with the most kids more, much more than other groups of families, like benefits that go to low-income seniors, like help for students. And all of the talk about housing right now, the necessity of the federal government to make investments to increase housing supply, affordability constraints that people have. Federal government has to make investments and do real work to actually make a difference in people's lives. If we talk about that in a very specific, direct way, and again, if the federal government succeeds in drawing that contrast with what the alternative is, specifically with Pierre Poilievre, who doesn't ever like to talk about what he would want to cut other than notional things like foreign aid, which we know would not make a dent in the budget, then we have a different conversation. But in the abstract, of course, it's easy to say, yeah, we should have a smaller deficit. We shouldn't be spending as much,
right.
Especially when you put aside the fact that internationally, Canada's fiscal situation is quite good, especially when you compare it to other G7 countries, is the envy of many other rich countries around the world.
But Andrew, how do you politically draw the Conservatives into that sort of a contrast? I mean, they're very disciplined on what they want to talk about. They're obviously not going to roll out a detailed sort of, path to fixing the budget, as they say, well in advance of an election. The things they have said they will cut, like the CBC, for example, will not solve the problem. It's $1 billion or so, but it's not the $40 billion that you need. How do you draw them into that argument that Cameron seems to want to see the government have if the other side won't engage?
Right. So, I mean, this is the smart thing that the government is doing is they're starting to eat up the room. There won't be a lot of room for, any of the parties to promise grandiose new schemes without coming forward some kind of an offset. I think the problem is, as I'm listening to what Cameron's saying, is though the pieces that they're signaling that they think, they want to put on the Tories as being potential cuts like the child benefit, I don't think anybody believes the Tories are actually going to cut that. Mm-hmm. And so, the question is, is there enough of a package there that an opposition can come in and still say, yeah, but there's a lot of fat in this government? 26% increase in the public service, massive increases in contracting out, just hand over fist waste in terms of the procurement systems. Those are the kind of things that I think Canadians still buy into that, yeah, there's still probably room to be found in that without having to cut any of the other programs that they're like, whatever they are. I think there are questions about how things like dental care that aren't really yet embedded in the Canadian psyche or the pharmacare programs, are those at risk? Are they not? Do Canadians really care about them? Do they don't? Those are the pieces that I think are on the margins. But there's still lots of room for opposition, either an opposition that wants to spend, as the NDP may want to be able to do, and say, look, you've got to put the tax on, the high-profit corporations, maybe not the high earners, but certainly on the high-profit corporations. And we've got to be able to fund the public services and the infrastructure that's needed. Conversely, the Conservatives can point to, the sense that there's bloat, whether there is or not, within government, as an opportunity to be able to cut back without going into those kind of programs that Cameron and obviously the Liberals want to be able to say the Tories are putting a target on.
So, Shashi, what do you make of that dynamic that as Andrew spelled it out? I mean, is there enough space there, and certainly in public opinion, whatever the fiscal situation is, for the Conservatives to push back against the idea that things you really value are on the table here?
The bar right now is so low for the Conservatives and so high for the Liberals, as is often the case, when you're dealing with third-term governments. The Liberals themselves need to try and do four things, and it's a tall order. First of all, they need to actually generate awareness of all the announcements they're making. Just because we're all talking about it on Power and Politics doesn't necessarily mean even awareness of these announcements is punching through in terms of Canadians and their everyday lives. And we've seen some data out, I think, from Abacus today showing that there's very low awareness on some of these announcements, this flurry of announcements that's come in the last 10, 14 days. So you look at that. You look at the fact that they have the task to reassure Canadians who are starting to get nervous about spending levels that from their perspective, this is not a level of spending to be worried about. They need to get Canadians excited about the prospect of the benefits of these things and then motivated enough to actually want to vote for the party in order to continue these things or to then put the Conservatives into a corner around, well, if you don't vote Liberal, the Conservatives are going to cut all of that. They need to do three things before they even get to that argument or make that case to Canadians. And at this stage, you really do wonder the extent to which people have crossed their arms, covered their ears, or have simply tuned out of the Liberal song, or if in the context of an actual campaign, which we're not expecting for quite some time yet, Canadians will dial in at that point. But for the time being, as campaigny as it might feel to us these days with an announcement today, I do question the extent to which Canadians are dialed in and focusing on what government is saying as they're busy trying to deal with a lot of these affordability issues.
Okay. Look, gang, we're out of time. I can't encroach on the next segment. But thanks so much to the Power Panel, Cameron Ahmad, Andrew Thompson, James Moore, and Shacha Curl. Thanks so much, gang.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau welcomed France's new Prime Minister to Parliament Hill today. It's Gabriel Attal's first international trip outside of Europe since landing this high-profile job. French President Emmanuel Macron appointed Attal to the role of Prime Minister in January. It's the second highest office in France, and the appointment was historic. At 35, Attal is France's youngest prime minister ever, and he is the country's first openly gay head of government. He is viewed as Macron's potential successor in the 2027 presidential election. But before that, he has to help Macron and his party fend off the rise of Marine Le Pen and her far-right party in upcoming European elections. While in Ottawa, Attal and Trudeau announced plans to strengthen bilateral cooperation on fighting wildfires and joint action on climate change. I sat down with the French Prime Minister this morning for an exclusive CBC News interview. Prime Minister, welcome to Canada. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. This, as I understand it, is your first international trip outside of Europe. Why Canada? What are you hoping to accomplish on this visit?
It is my first trip abroad the EU since I was appointed Prime Minister. And I really wanted to do this trip in Canada because Canada is such a strong friend, a strong ally, a strong partner for France. You know, we are the two only countries that are both in G7, G20, NATO, and Francophonie organization. We share some common values, the freedom, progress, and democracy. And so it was very important for me to be here in Canada to handle some very important issues, such as the fight against climate change or Francophonie. And I'm very happy to be here.
On climate change, there's been pushback in this country on the use of carbon pricing as a mechanism to deal with emissions, reduce emissions, and to fight climate change. Is that part of your conversations with Prime Minister Trudeau? And what do you say to people who are skeptical of pricing as a way to deal with this?
Well, there are decisions which are internal decisions. Mm-hmm. But I think what is important is that both France and Canada, we share a roadmap for the fight against climate change, biodiversity, oceans. And so we will sign with Prime Minister Trudeau an agreement, a very important agreement, which handles some parts of, you know, the President Macron initiative, the 4P initiative, partnership for people and the planet. And so I think we will move forward on that. And then, you know, in every country, the transition is difficult. We in France had these debates about climate carbon pricing, and it's a difficult issue. But for our generation, it's, I think, the biggest challenge we have.
Well, you have common values and common goals in alignment with Canada, but also common unfinished business when it comes to trade, because there's the challenge now with getting the final ratification of the Canada-Europe trade agreement. Farmers in your country and across Europe are pushing back on this. Your Senate just voted against ratifying it. Is France turning against this deal?
No, I don't think so. You know, it's a good deal, and it's a win-win deal. I think it's been signed 6 years ago, and since then, our trade exchanges raised by more than 30%. And so it's a good deal both for Canada and for France. Figures don't lie. The National Assembly in France ratified the deal. And the Senate, where we don't have, you know, the majority, mm-hmm. President Macron and us, decided to block it, I think for political reasons, because there are the European elections coming. So I think we will give time to time. The agreement still applies. And I'm quite confident in convincing all MPs that it's a good deal for France and for Canada. But also for France and for French farmers as well. You know, the revenue for French farmers by trade with Canada raised also and increased. So we will show, I think, that it's a good deal for France.
The argument from a lot of farmers, as I understand it, is the environmental regulations on this side of the mm-hmm. of the ocean are lower and make your farmers less competitive. But the defeat in the Senate, political or not, was significant. 211 against, just 44 in favor. With that kind of an opposition, how do you get CETA over the finish line?
We have two chambers in the French Parliament, National Assembly and the Senate. We don't have the majority at the Senate, but in the end, many of our bills still pass in the Parliament because we have the majority, relative majority at the National Assembly. But you know, regarding environmental issues in the deal, what is important for French farmers is that we have standards here in Canada on farmers as well, and so we don't import some goods with lower standards than the goods that are made and produced by French farmers. And we have this security in the CETA deal. And you know, we don't have this security in the Mercosur deal, which is right. Negotiated by the EU with the South American countries. That's why we blocked the Mercosur deal. So when a deal is not good for trade and for French people, French farmer, we block it. But the CETA deal is a good deal, both for France and for Canada.
This trade skepticism or resistance, though, you mentioned the European elections. This is all sort of happening at a time when Marine Le Pen and her party are at high watermarks in terms of popularity. And we're seeing this sort of movement across Western countries, sort of against incumbency, against multilateralism, against freer trade, as people embrace populism. Is there a connection between the CETA resistance and those political forces, and how do you navigate that as a government?
I'm not sure there's a connection, but you know, we see in every European country that populist and far-right movements are rising. I think we must be very careful about that. But I'm convinced that French citizens and citizens all across the EU know that with all the challenges we're facing, the return of the war in Europe, climate change, and many other challenges, we need to stand together and we need to work as European Union and with allies to tackle and to handle them. And that's not what populist and far-right movements are bearing.
But yet people seem to be embracing it, right? We've seen what happened in the Netherlands with Geert Wilders, and we do see this increase. The specter of Donald Trump looms in the United States. There are shifts in German politics. It's sort of like a post-COVID surge in a certain direction. How do you push back against it in France? How do you push back against it?
But you know, post-COVID, there was a presidential election in France in 2022, and President Macron was elected against Marine Le Pen and against far-right movement, the Rassemblement National. So I committed in politics because I think we can change things, and also because I think that the polls don't... what is important is are the votes, and
right.
We must convince French citizens to vote for a pro-European Union candidate, which is the candidate I support in the European elections.
You mentioned President Macron defeating Marie Le Pen in 2022. He can't run again in 2027 because he is term limited by your constitution. A lot of people point to you as a possible successor to President Macron. Will we see you potentially running against Marie Le Pen in 2027?
I think all of these discussions is fiction. The next election is in 2027. We are in 2024, and I think French people want me to commit today on 2024 issues and are not really interested in what will happen in 3 years. We have a president, Emmanuel Macron. We are very lucky in France to have him as a president. And I'm only committed on my mission as prime minister.
You mentioned the war in Europe. I want to talk, if I can, about what is happening in Ukraine, because Russia is gaining territory in Ukraine as Ukraine complains about slow delivery of aid from Western nations, in particular the United States. Poland's prime minister says that Europe is in a pre-war era and the continent is not ready. Do you agree with that assessment from Donald Tusk?
You know, we are seeing the return of war on the European continent. 2 years ago, when the war began and the Russian aggression began, many people thought that Ukraine could not resist. And since 2 years, we've seen Ukraine resisting. And Ukraine is resisting because Ukrainians are very brave, the president is very brave, but also because we support them as France and as the European Union. France gave 7 billion euros of military support to Ukraine. So we will keep on supporting Ukraine to resist against Russia, because after Ukraine, it's the European Union. And many European Union countries, and you mentioned Poland, are scared about what could come next. So what we are fighting for is Ukraine's freedom, but it's also our values and the people's and the country's sovereignty and the European Union's value.
But are we fighting for it hard enough and fast enough? I spoke with a representative of the Estonian foreign ministry the other day, and we talked about how Russia essentially has an economy the size of Canada's, roughly the size of Spain's, and yet it is holding on against the collective might of all the Western democracies who are part of this alliance, who should be able to overcome this, but domestic political issues in particular are stopping the flow at the pace Ukraine is asking for.
All the Russian economy is now turned on the war. But Ukraine is resisting because we are supporting Ukraine. And as France, as European Union, with allies such as Canada, which who has a decisive support also for Ukraine, they are resisting. But it's true that we need to do more. We need to do even more. That's why we had a very important meeting in Paris, you know, with leaders from all over the world. And Canada was represented at that meeting. And that's why also the NATO summit on July in Washington will be very important to keep on increasing our support for Ukraine, because Russia can't win this war.
The NATO summit in July, it's clear where President Joe Biden stands in his support of NATO and his support of Ukraine. It's also clear, arguably, where Donald Trump stands. And less than a year from now, he could be the U.S. president. He opposes U.S. aid in Ukraine. He has questioned the very foundational principles of collective defense of NATO. How is France preparing for a possible Trump presidency?
I don't want to meddle in the U.S. internal politics and election. But what I will tell you as the French prime minister and as a European is that I don't want France and the EU security to depend on others. We need to depend mostly on ourselves. We need a second lifeguard. We have NATO, but we also need to increase even more our defense policy in the EU to have this other lifeguard. So I don't want our security, I don't want our choices, I don't want our ability to support Ukraine to depend on elections over the Atlantic.
Are you worried, though, that President Trump could abandon NATO, he could abandon Europe if Russian hostilities escalate? Because he has sent clear signals going back to his first trip to Brussels as president that he's not happy with the way NATO is functioning.
Again, I don't want to meddle in these elections, but I say that we need to also handle ourselves in the EU. And that's the project from the President Macron, you know, since 2017. He had a very important speech at the Sorbonne saying that we need a European sovereignty and we need a European defense budget and a European defense policy. And that's what we did the last years. And I think we have many other things to do ahead.
On issues of military spending, we have seen a significant increase in spending from European members of NATO. Germany obviously comes to mind. France is just below the 2% spending target.
Yeah,
I think you're
2%.
At 1.9. You're basically there. Mm. But Canada's only at about 1.3%. The government announced a plan this week to get it closer to 1.75, 1.76%, but not until the end of this decade. Is Canada doing enough on defense, given the collective challenge that NATO is facing, from your view?
I think I don't have to comment on that, but what I will say, I will say that the most important thing, first, is being present in multilateral assemblies, because as adults, we have first to do diplomacy and to try to talk to each other. Then, the situation we're seeing in Ukraine today shows that we need to prepare ourselves for any situation.
Right.
That's why we decided in France to increase a lot our defense budget since between the President Macron's election in 2017 and the end of his second term in 2027, we will have doubled the defense budget in France. So we are at the 2%. I saw that Canada presented and gave public defense plan, increasing their defense spending. And you know, what I want to say is that France, I think, is a reliable partner for Canada to increase its defense mechanisms, as well as for strategic and industrial support.
On that, one of the ideas, the aspirations in Canada's defense plan that they rolled out is the acquisition of new submarines, in particular to deal with Arctic sovereignty and patrolling, you know, as the ice pack melts. Is France part of that? Are there conversations between Canada and France about acquiring French-made submarines?
You know, we have a very strong defense industry in France with, for instance, Naval Group and other industrial giants regarding the defense industry. And I know that there are talks between these companies and many countries. You know, we had some announcements from the Netherlands a few weeks ago. So that's why I said that I think we can be a very reliable partner for Canada on these issues.
One last issue to speak with you about, sir, is the Israel-Hamas war. France, Canada, other countries have called for a ceasefire there and certainly an increase in humanitarian aid. We watch what's happening in the United States, where there seems to be an increasing frustration with the way Benjamin Netanyahu and his military and government are conducting this war. But so far, U.S. support hasn't come with conditions, at least not in terms of military aid and support. Can you get to a ceasefire without more pressure from the United States, given the dynamic at play in Israel and in Gaza right now?
First, I want to remember that this dramatic situation in Gaza comes from the terrorist attack from Hamas on Israelis. And it's very important to remember that there was on October 7th a terrible terrorist attack, and Israel decided to fight back also for hostages. We still have three hostages, French hostages, in Gaza right now, and we really want to get them home. The second thing is that the situation today in Gaza is dramatic and quite unbearable at some points. And so we need a ceasefire in order to end this spiral of violence. There are many debates in many countries and also in the U.S. We saw a few weeks ago that a resolution from the Security Council in the U.N. was voted calling for a ceasefire. So we're seeing also the U.S. Supporting and moving for a ceasefire.
Okay. With just as a final question, with everything that is happening in Europe, everything that's happening in the Middle East, there is an insecurity happening globally. Your country is about to host the Olympics in just a few months. I know the recent attacks in Moscow. This was an organization, this ISIS group, that your government has said was thwarted from launching attacks on French soil in recent months. How concerned are you about the security situation as you get ready to welcome the world to host the Olympics?
You know, we've been preparing these Olympics and Paralympics games for years now, and it will be a very important gathering around our values and the Olympic values. And security is our top priority for the organization of these games in the summer in Paris. And we've been working a lot on the security issues. We have many partners around the EU also supporting us on that. And so I'm quite confident about what we've been doing to handle the security during these Olympic games.
Prime Minister, it was very good to meet you. Thank you for coming
today.
Enjoy your trip to Canada. That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.